here this morning, I gathered that there's something serious and very tragic had happened. I didn't know what it was until something about Mexico, but I hadn't a clue. When did this information come through, do you know, Peter, or any of you?
And then the bus carrying 46 Adventists went over a cliff.
I don't know whether that was the same one that's shown on television. May have been the same. Thank you. Yeah, I didn't really. Yeah. So I had heard of it, but I didn't know. I had the opposite this morning. Somebody who knows about the internet, I looked up my internet and I found a name that I was not 2013, mind you, back, and yet I'd known I'd contacted this lady a lot time before that or after that. And anyway, I decided yesterday to find out a little bit how she's getting on, etc. And I hadn't looked at it. It might have been Thursday because I was preparing this service yesterday, and I looked at it this morning in a hurry because I was late getting ready, and here it was. And she said about how she was going. Well, she'd maintained a faith. I'd studied with her years before in Warrnambool, and now she's now happily married after quite an issue with the first husband, who really treated her badly, legally and emotionally. So that was some very good news, and I just had to rush in a hurry. So I'm late for church service in Hamilton, but wow, and a few with dot, dot, dots with so happy for her. So that was really good. Okay, I said to Peter, and I was on the train actually, going to see a certain lady that I know, and Peter said, and I thought it was her call, ringing me up. And it was Peter, and I thought, it'd be about my service. And he said, what is the sermon title? And I said, oh, it's about Revelation 17 or the heads of Revelation 17 or something, because I knew that was something what I was going to deal with. It wasn't really what the full topic was, but, it was enough to get that across. And my approach to Revelation 17 will be very, very different to what you hear mostly, except the latter part, which will be basically about Revelation 17. And for the younger set of people here, and for the older ones as well, I'm going to diverge, and I'm going to deal with aspects of something that would be understood a lot by some of the oldies, and not understood by some of the youngies. And then I'm going to deal with about our own time, which they've heard a lot about, which they experience themselves. And then I'm going to apply what I'm dealing with in these things to Revelation 17 and go through the prophecy itself to see. And look, there's so much in this prophecy to understand it properly that it takes a lot more time than I will have. But I will endeavour to do what I can. So I might have to get this board back a bit further. I do sometimes find myself doing the same thing in Warrnambool Church and that. But anyway, now I'm going to, in a sense, do a little bit of a personal background story. And at first you might think that what I'm going to deal with is irrelevant to the whole picture of Revelation 17 and understanding the prophecy. But I'm going to take you back to the 50s and 60s. Now, young ones here, never knew what the 50s and 60s were like, so that will be irrelevant to you. A number of us will remember some things of the 50s and 60s. Now, I'll just put this 50s, 60s, right. Now, I'll put that in a box for the moment, and I can't write down all the things that I'm going to mention. But I was a young lad in the 50s and 60s, and perhaps I've told you some of the story before, but I can remember some of it. I should be able to, because it applied to me. I came from a background of no church. I'd never been to a church. I never went to church services. Couldn't be bothered with such things. That was some of my early memories. I was never brought up in a church, so I had no idea what churches were like. And the society in which I lived in that time, back in Melbourne, was interesting when I reflect on it for now and see how different it was to the way in which we live today. Some of you will know what I'm talking about. We had come through the experience of World War II, and that influenced the thinking. And we started to have migrants come from different countries to our country. In fact, the lady I'm going with actually came through World War II. After World War II, but she endured what happened after with the communist regime in Poland. We had also, following World War II, the beginnings of the Cold War between the United States and the Western world and the Soviet Union. And this brought a lot of terror and fear among a lot of people because it was the start of the arms race. And so that had some influence, particularly in the 60s. But I want to talk about the 50s for a moment when I was a lad. In those days, there was quite a definite, very definite clash between Catholic and Protestant people. You were either one or the other. And there was definitely a great deal of problems if you met a Catholic girl and you were Protestant, or a Protestant girl meeting a Catholic boy, because what they would try and do is make sure that you became one of them. And this created no end of trouble. And we used to see, and I might be rude when I think about this, but we used to call the nuns black crows. Though I wasn't a Protestant, I wasn't anything. But when I think of it now, some of those dear ladies were wonderful Christians. And some of the priests, wonderful Christians. I think of it differently now. But we lived in a very structured society. There were so many things that showed this. We had outwardly high moral standards. I said outwardly because inwardly people are no different, but there was a sense of conformity that you didn't go outside these guidelines that most people lived by. The role of men and the role of women was very firmly established. And it was so obvious that. It's a laugh, I look at it today, but when ladies went down the street in those days to buy some groceries, etc., they would be all done up. They looked really nice. They wouldn't go like they look today, sometimes sloppy and whatnot. And the men the same. Even men used to ride their bikes with suits on to go to work in the 50s. I remember that. You might say, it might have been their old suit, but it didn't matter. But still, that's what sometimes often happened. And and women sort of knew their place and men sort of knew their place. And they sort of were quite satisfied to do that in most cases. A few mightn't have been, but that was bad luck if you didn't. When I went to school, the schools mostly, primary school you had girls and boys together, that was no trouble. As soon as you went to secondary schools, girls went to another school, the boys went to another school, separated most of the time. And of course more males went to school in those days. The girls, when they're about year 8, year 9, went home. You got some jobs if you could and whatnot, or you stayed home or something like that, but the boys got the jobs. And even when you're only at year 9, you could become an apprentice, plumber, builder, you name it. There were that many jobs available. There was hardly any problem about unemployment because the country was expanding like anything. As for entertainment, well, when I think of it compared with today, I remember well and truly going to many films. I used to like films. All films were censored. There was no nudity. There was no outward filth and corruption that you see in picture form in those days. It wasn't allowed. It was highly censored. There was dancing on Saturday nights. Oh, well, that's when the girls put on their finery. The blokes would be dressed up in sports coats and or suits and something like this. People looked realistic, you know. It was a way in which they lived that way. And then there was sport. And that only happened on a Saturday. Sports. You had nothing happen on a Sunday. It was quite, you know, that was a time changed a bit and started in the 60s. But that was right. And that's, as I said, the Saturday night, the girls were dressed with these flared skirts and dresses, and they'd have corsages, and they looked absolutely wonderful. And us blokes used to, well, we used to know them, etc. When I was younger, the very late 40s and early 50s, I used to go with my cousin. I was only not even a proper teenager then, before that. And we used to go to Saturday matinees on the picture theatre. Well, talk about noise and racket. Kids were, they'd be screaming and yelling when the hero came on the screen and whatnot, and kids would throw lollies down on the floor and all the rest of it. It was bedlam and whatnot. I have to laugh about that when I look back at it. But these days, different. The society was much more church orientated. A lot more people went to church and believed in church and followed their church. I also found that the police could be tough in those days. I don't know how many young boys got a good kick in the backside by a policeman and knew very well if they got out of line, the next place they would be locked up. And the police could do that, and they were allowed to do it. They were tough on crime. And you didn't have this crime that you have happening today. The main vices were smoking and drinking, and unfortunately so many young blokes took up smoking when they were only in early teen years. But there was work, plentiful of work, and when you looked around, you wouldn't see graffiti. Hardly anything like that. Of course, there was no spray cans then, so it was good. And at nights, women, for the most part, were pretty safe to walk the streets, not like today. It's so different. No sport on Sundays, but gradually changes took place in the early 60s. Then TV came into being. I know it started in the end of 1956 when we had the Olympic Games, but before that there was no TV in Australia. And what you had was little screens, black and white, and they were very expensive to buy the early TV sets. Very expensive, believe me. Entertainment started to increase on the Sundays as well, but, you know, it was still pretty strict censorship. The early 60s, it was only in the late 60s when things started to change. As far as music, as far as young people were concerned, there was the Bill Haley and the Comets, Elvis Presley, this was in the 50s. And then when you come into the 60s, there was the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, a fit of that, and I never liked any of that. Well, I might have in early time, but I'm a classical interested in anyway. But our life then was much less materialistic than what it is today. And there was much more family structure. Kids knew their place, and parents cared about what their children did and tried to make sure they didn't get out of line. Not like you see today. And so, from my point of view, I think people then were much happier than what they are today. They didn't live to the same degree of fear within their society. They might have lived in fear when the Cold War really got into a stride about nuclear armament. But apart from that, no. And that was the 50s and 60s. I'm doing that for a purpose because when I talk about Revelation 17, part of this will make some sense to you. During those 50s and 60s, now I'm going to skite a bit here, no I'm not really, but I'm going to talk about myself, you know, and you don't want to hear about yourself, but you know, sometimes I might explain it something. In those 50s and 60s, I made three great decisions, the best decisions I've ever made in my life. As I said, I had no church background, I had no interest in religion, except I went to St. Paul's Cathedral with my father on Easter, I might have been 14 or 15, or 13 or something like that. And it was the most boring thing I'd ever put up with. And I determined never going to go to that again, listen to all that tripe. Anyway, About 1957-58, I went to a senior tech school to do engineering, and I met this fellow, this one of these kids. He's shorts back and sides and everything like, and he was always singing hymns and whatnot. I thought, oh, what a religious nut. Anyway, that's how I thought of him, because that's how he seemed. Then he asked me to go to a religious meeting. It was in 1958. It was about Easter time, approximately. And I went to this great big exhibition building in Melbourne with that big dome, you know. Somehow I went there. Don't ask me why I went there. I don't know. Perhaps my mother was praying, but she didn't go to church either, but she was finding a way. I went to this building, and there were these thousands of people, women with long hair, all dressed basically the same, the men all in suits, short back and sides. There must have been 2,000-3,000 of them. They were exclusive brethren. And I didn't know what they were, but I went in that night, and the preacher got up to preach from Daniel 7 about the judgment. That night turned my life upside down. Really turned my life upside down. I realized that there was a judgment and that religion was real. And as a result, I started going to church for the exclusive brethren. Let me tell you, there were some very nice people among them, very committed people. I found that they were a bit off on some things, as I found. But ultimately, I became a Seventh-day Adventist at the end of that year. And don't ask me how that happened, but Mum and I were baptised in the end of 58, and even though she didn't come the same way. And it was the first and best decision I have ever made in my life. But followed from that were the battles with sin. Yeah, I've started to find religion. I read myself into everything I could, etc., etc. And I went to college in 1960. Okay, I started to understand Seventh-day Adventist religious beliefs as I read the scriptures and other books. I read so many books of Ellen G. White. But I found we were largely legalistic. It was very structured, but we had a lot of activities in church, and that was helpful. I went to Preston Church, and if Alec was here, he would understand this. There was Roy and Bill as well, and a few other people. Their influence on me was tremendous. I thank God for them. And the church was full of activity on Sabbath. Oh, we had Sabbath school. Everybody turned up to Sabbath school. You go to a lot of our churches today and there's nobody at Sabbath school. Very few. Sabbath school was vibrant. There was a lot of things on. And then the church service, you were challenged by it. Then we had lunch together sometimes. Then we had an afternoon meeting for the young people. And a lot of the oldies used to turn up as well. That was really great. We had that. And then the evenings, there was a socials on, and of course I went there and so forth and that. So the whole Sabbath was taken up. I used to, at first, miss going into Melbourne on Saturday mornings for shopping. Started not to miss it after a while, because once this it had filled in that. And anyway, all right, and there was plenty of young ladies. Oh, that was, wow, that was good. Okay, anyway. When I came to this church, I found that I had a little bit of a problem after reading some material, because I heard time and again some of our ministers, etc., talking about this Battle of Armageddon. And I read Uriah Smith's book and I studied from it, and here it was a battle between aeroplanes and tanks and armies all fighting in a plain of Megiddo in Palestine. And I heard this just didn't make sense, because I also read Great Controversy. And I thought this, and there were some other preachers or some other people started to realize that there was something wrong with this interpretation of Revelation 16. And that started me thinking. And this is why I'm going to talk about Revelation 17, because it'll help a little bit. And I know that this battle of Armageddon came from having World War II. This same sort of thinking had this way, thinking that the battle between good and evil would be solved by armies fighting one another. Totally way off. But anyway, that's what happened. I did come in contact with a man who wrote this book. He was one of the big promoters in our work of the proper interpretation of the book of Revelation. A proper I'm not saying he's right in everything, but Lou Weir. He was defrocked. But a lot of some other scholars in our church organization were seeing things the same way. So that was interesting. And I'll come to that. That was the first big decision. Anyway, what it is a danger of seeing prophecy being fulfilled by events that you see taking place don't necessarily fulfill the prophecy. The prophecies have to have specifics that point out what is happening. Anyway, that might seem irrelevant. Second big decision I made was, a third decision I made was going to college. What a background I got. And it's been very, very helpful. I don't regret one bit going to Avondale at all at that particular time. We had great lecturers, etc. And I got a broader understanding of our message, etc. And I became, I hope, a more understanding and balanced male as a result. And there were plenty of lovely, gorgeous girls there. That was wonderful. That was the third best decision I made. The second best decision I made was I was doing plenty of conference work, and then I met a lovely, wonderful girl, woman from Warrnambool. And some of you know her, or knew of her. She was a great minister's wife. She was good with people. She was hospitable. She had great presence with a microphone, cooking demonstrations, church activities. So this was a very wise decision. I never regretted it. That was the second major decision, of best decision I ever made in my life. Never regretted it. The only regret I have is she died. And she died unexpectedly. And we had a very wonderful marriage. And I just say to every one of you, your marriages reflect what you are like. And it's a very important factor of your whole growth in some respects. And ours was a very romantic marriage. Some people get the wrong idea as soon as you say romance. But let me tell you, it was. And et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to go into it anymore. I just wish that sometimes that we would reflect on that as husbands and wives and boost each other up and compliment each other and express how grateful we are for one another. And how much that you mean to me or I mean to you, etc. This is so significantly important, and we don't see enough of it. But anyway, I don't want to get past that. But I noticed it came into the 70s onwards. Here we go, 70s onwards. 70s, things changed. In fact, they started in the late 60s, but the 70s onwards, things started to change. I'd noticed John the 23rd came in 1958, and that started to change a few things as far as prophecy was concerned with the Second Vatican Council. But the attitude between Catholic and Protestant was starting to change. There was much more acceptance of either one. That was starting to change. Okay. In some regards, that was good. However, society was changing and not always for the better. This is when the hippie society came and all this. Censorship laws were, well, they went haywire. We had crudity, nudity, you name it, was starting to come on the screens on what you could buy and so forth. And this sort of thing. This was before the internet really came into change. And I found from my experience, I left the work and I went into teaching, and I found what I wish that a lot of ministers understood, because I found it from my own experiences in reality, how difficult it is being a layman to try and win people. I found that out from hard experience. Whereas ministers work usually among very religious people, or usually religious people. We were having a humanistic society starting to develop, a secular society. People didn't respect authority as much anymore. Police were having more and more troubles, and this was because of the drug infiltration of just about every aspect of society, starting from the 70s, etc. There were two important events that took place in the 70s, 80s. In 78, Pope John Paul was elected. There began a huge, huge shift in the, should I say, the fulfillment of prophecy. We could now see a church that was coming to the fore. And in 1980, Ronald Reagan was elected President of the United States, and he started to make America great in terms of military power, etc. And this was those two contestants in Revelation 13. Rather interesting. Prophecy predictors. Anyway, all of you, or most of you, have been through 1989, 1991. I remember way back in the 50s, Lou Weir was saying that Revelation 13, the second beast of Revelation 13, could not be fulfilled while the USSR had so much power. Our own commentators were feeling the heat about that, as how could America be great when the USSR was so great? Then in 89, 91, the USSR was no more. Because of what happened, 78 and 80, those two men were largely responsible for the fall of the USSR. And that was so significant. But the society in which we started to live from the 70s onwards, well, I put the pen, right through to 2017, is so different from this type of society. Moralistically, religiously, it's so secular, it's so, you know, there's not many people go to church like there used to be, etc. And I'll go into some of this in greater detail. Now I want to get into Revelation 17, where I'm saying about this. We ask ourselves, what has happened to society today and in the Western world? What has happened? What has caused this? What is the reason for it? Why is it like this? How is it that it's so different from the 50s? Not to say the 50s were okay in every way, because it wasn't. It was a very racist sort of country we had. We didn't like foreigners, you know. Oh, those people, yeah, etc. Sorry, but that was the way, was a white Australian policy back there in the 50s, etc. We see Satan's all-out attack at the present time, but it's very different from the way Revelation 13 pictures things. Now that's going to be significant, because I can tell you Revelation 17 answers a few questions on Revelation 13 in some ways. And I said, when I was here last time, I said about an influence that has been so strong that has created this sort of society today. And that influence came from Revelation 11. The beast that comes from the abyss, revolutionary France. And the ideas of the French Revolution have penetrated and perpetrated the whole Western world. So much so that we have these confusing things we see everywhere around us. The sexual revolution in particular. The promiscuity in every hand. All of a sudden we have the gay revolution. We have pedophilia. We have pornography on such a vast scale. We have the mass prostitution. Foul language is allowed. The F word is just about in every film these days. The media and the TV and the internet promote, and you can get whatever you want. The foulest of sort of things that you can have. Humans with animals and all the rest you can find on the TV, on the internet. All these filthy, vile things are there. That's the influence of a humanistic society. But not all of it is bad. Not all of it is bad. We do see the growing violence in our cities today. We see uncertainty in the world of finance. We also see the political instability. You just have to look at France and the parts of Europe and parts of other countries, even Egypt and whatnot. You see the Muslim influence, etc. We also see little interest in Christianity. Freedom has gone astray. It's gone crazy. Secularism opposes any influence of religion. And on with that, combined with that, we have the evolutionary theory, and with it, the anti-Genesis apostasy, because people don't believe in the book of Genesis hardly any in these days, as a result of it. All of these factors have combined to make this world of what it is at the present time. And these are affecting us. And we ask ourselves, while we're in this mess up, which we are, the world, the Western world is in particular in this mess up, what is stopping Revelation 13 taking place, which we know will take place? What is it about that this is stopping? One part of the religion or the ideas of the French Revolution, which came from America, which wasn't atheistic, the American Revolution, is the fact of two important ideas: civil liberty and religious liberty. The French had had enough of being controlled by the papacy for hundreds of years, and they overthrew it. France is a very secular, anti-religious country these days. So is Western Germany. So is even Italy. So is Spain even these days. And many of, and England, of course, as well. These ideas that we have in Western society, Australia obviously is another one. America is this. Civil and religious liberty. Americans didn't have to get it from the French Revolution. They already were the beginners of it. But the ideas of civil and religious liberty are what is restraining Revelation 13 from happening. And I wanted to go into this and explaining it in some help from Revelation 17. Our liberties at the present time are starting to be tightened, largely because of radical Islamic terrorism. And in Great Controversy, page 269, Ellen White called the French Revolution a new manifestation of satanic power. A new manifestation, because it was new before that. And when we come to Revelation 17, like a parts of some of the book of Revelation, not all of the book of Revelation, by any stretch of the imagination, we have to look at it from a different standpoint in terms of time. Now, these things, these factors will come into it a bit, as I've said. All right. Now, when you read the seven churches, you read it from the time of the apostles. And it goes through from the time of the apostles. The seven seals, you read it from the time of the apostles till Christ's coming. You read the trumpets, time of Christ, time of the apostles to end of time, etc. When you come to Revelation 13 and Revelation 17, if you get the right perspective, you must read it and see it from our time, not back in the time of the apostles, because they never saw it. They never had a clue, really, as to what it would be like, because they didn't live in that time. They wouldn't have understood a lot of the other things, but they certainly wouldn't have understood this. Okay, Revelation 17. Let's go to part of it. It's a detailed study, and I'll try and make it as simple as I can, which I want you to see it from the perspective of our time. Our time. Okay. All right. Here you have the picture. One of the seven angels, here it is, who had the seven bowls, came to said, now as the seven bowls refer to the seven last plagues, remember that? Come and I'll show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. Mine is the NIV. I don't know whether you'll have something similar with the New King James, etc. With her, kings of the earth, with her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into the desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. She held in her cup, held a golden cup in her hand, filled with the abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This title was written on her forehead: Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I only have a little picture here. This is not a good picture. But if I was picturing it today, and I've seen some newer ones about it, the woman is, the prostitute is riding on the beast, and the beast has 7 heads, and they've got 10 horns. Now, if you're drawing it today, the woman would be, have, what a prostitute would be, plunging neckline, skirt, and all that showing of thighs and everything else, if you know what I mean. That would be the picture that John most likely would got the picture of what it was like. Because this is the wicked woman. The Protestant reformers referred to this as none other than the papacy. That's as they saw it. But in the real picture, at our time, it is more than just the papacy, but very important player. A very, very important player from Revelation 17. And then it gives us a little bit more about it. And it says there in verse 6, which to me gives a great clue. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. It goes back to Daniel 7, doesn't it? About the beast that would persecute. Drunk with the blood of the saints, loves to persecute, etc. Then 7 and 8, here we have the problem. Then the angel said to me, "Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction." This beast, big beast, you know, leopard or whatever it is, the big beast, forget the heads at the time, was, is not, will come up again. Okay. That leaves you a bit confused. Okay. Then it goes further to even confuse you more. Anyway. Okay. And it says about this beast, "The inhabitants of the earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world will be astonished when they see the beast," this beast, "because he once was, now is not, and yet will come." The same sort of thing. You've got, I put pens. I oftentimes like me trying to find my glasses half the time. He's here, he's not, he's here again. He rises. Okay. There he is. Is not, is again. Okay. Very confusing. Let's see it from our personal perspective and think of Revelation 2. Was. Sorry. Good. Thank you. Was. Yeah, important. Was is past tense. Not now. Okay. Was. Is. Not. Is. Okay. All right. Now, then you come to verse 9. This calls for a mind with wisdom. In other words, it'll take you some understanding. The 7 heads are 7 hills on which the woman sits. Now, that's a giveaway. Which city has the 7 hills? Nothing else but the city of Rome. That gives a clue. That's straight out. On which the woman sits. They are also 7 kings. 5 are fallen. 1 is, and the other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for a little while. The beast who once was, and now is not, is an 8th king. He belongs to the 7 and is going to destruction. His destruction. I'll forget the last part because it deals with the horns. All right. Now, this case, 5 are fallen. What One is not, isn't it? If I've got it right there, is it? I'll read it again. Five. One is. Oh, it is this time. Now, in this one, it says is. When it says is not, and yet he will come again. Rather interesting, isn't it? And when he comes again, he'll come into destruction. Now, I read from Lou Weir's one, and I didn't quite agree with his enunciation of the numbers of the places. I looked in Uriah Smith's book, and I was totally confused. I want to explain the ideas behind it. All right. If we follow Daniel's prophecies, we have five major kingdoms. Number one. Two. Right? You all know these. Three. Greece. Four. Rome. But if you look at that particularly careful, pagan. Five. Papal. In today's world, these powers are no longer powerful. They no longer exist. This one still exists, but he doesn't exist in terms of power, papal. This is talking about powers to persecute, to hurt, to challenge God's people. And then it says this part, there's their sixth head. The sixth head is here. Head. Is not, virtually, or is, but is not doing anything. And then the seventh comes again. And he's of the eight. Very cunningly, the word eighth here means an indication that the seventh is resurrected from what he was. From here. He's a resurrection power. Now, if you read Revelation 7:13, what does it say about the first beast? What did it receive that destroyed its power? The deadly wound. When did that happen? 1798. That's the year, but I mean it was happening. It was losing its power towards that time. Then the French Directory sent Napoleon to sent Berthier there to take the Pope prisoner. And it did not recover and has not recovered its persecuting power. It is in the is-not stage. But the beast power is in its is-not stage, cannot persecute. But at the present, we are in a sixth head period that is stopping it from doing what it usually likes to do. This is where you have the secular society, a society that believes in civil and religious liberty, holding back the winds of strife, as it were, for the beast again to come to its own. That being the seventh head. And then you'll have Revelation 7:13, both powers are involved and more that will be involved. When you read Great Controversy, the whole thing starts to make sense. Starts to make sense. All of these powers were used by Satan, received the deadly wound. The sixth head, which is today, is still an anti-God power. But it still has two good things that it believes in: civil and religious liberty, which is protecting us and protecting the gospel and allowing the gospel to continue and providing with people who come into God's kingdom as a result. And what has happened to the woman is still there. The woman represents the church, the false church. But the woman is still there. The woman is still wanting to ride the beast. She is still in existence and she's doing well. But she hasn't got her mate, one of the powers, or any of the powers on earth, to do what she really wants to do, is to be able to control totally. She is hindered for the time being. And Revelation 13 tells us that it will start with the second beast that brings in the image to the beast. And then the beast itself, or the power of the church, will come to its own. That's when you come to verses 12 onwards, which is rather interesting, because this is, it explains it as well. And you read it in Great Controversy. You read it in Revelation 16 as well. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings which have not received a kingdom, but for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. Along with the beast. This is about this time. This is talking about the nations of the world will combine to work with the beast to persecute God's people. But notice here, they have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. In other words, they'll help the earthly powers. They will make war against the Lamb, who's the Lamb, Christ, but the Lamb will overcome them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and with him will his followers, etc., be called chosen and faithful. And then it goes on to say, what happens to the 10 kings? They are destroyed. They turn on the beast. Read it in the book Great Controversy. I wish unto God that we would take that book down and read the last 10 or the last 6 chapters and go through it thoroughly to see what is coming and what we know is happening at the present time. At the present, Ellen White never really saw this world in which we live at the present time, but she knew, must have known what was going to happen. Rick, reckon it? Yes, she's got some idea, but it's the secularist part that has happened to hold these things back is interesting. And what we know, and we have to bear in mind, that ultimately, who is going to triumph? The beast and the woman? Or who? The Christ and his church. His people. And out of Babylon will come his people. Out of Babylon will come his people. And he will be the protector. And that's why we can get some idea of what Revelation 17 is talking about. I'm not saying that I've done a perfect job in explaining it, because it is complex. But if you can get that idea, the powers of persecution have gone. We're in a stage where it is, the woman is still there, but power to do anything about it, to persecute, is not there at the present time, but will happen again, will come again, but will only last a very short time. It says an hour, I think it says, and will be ultimately destroyed. God will be the one who wins in the battle of Armageddon. This is the battle of Armageddon, this part, the destruction. And it won't be with aeroplanes and tanks or anything like that. It will be God delivering his people in a such a way that man has no power against. So I hope that it might make some little bit of sense to you to understand that. A very confusing part of prophecy, hard to sometimes get the things together. Anyway, thank you for listening. Lord in heaven, we pray that while we may not always understand everything, which is certainly human experience, and we go through trials and tribulations, though some of them are very minor in comparison to what some other believers in you have experienced, we pray that we might look at, to you to be the blessed hope for us, that coming of, that will take away all these things. And then beyond that will be the everlasting life. So wonderful that we cannot begin to imagine. We pray your blessing upon us today as we leave this place, because we ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen.